and survive in some of the most unlikely places. We've probably all seen the odd spectacle of a tree growing out of a rooftop somewhere around the square or some building. Wherever there's a collection of dirt big enough for the seed to find a little root. Or maybe you hike a trail and you get to the top of the peak of the hill, and there what appears to be nothing but rocks, and there's a craggly looking tree growing out of a crack in the hill, and you just think, how could a tree live here? I mean, how could it ever get started and survive long enough to take hold? Or you travel somewhere where there's not much rain in some desert part of the world, and invariably, except in the most harsh of places, you'll find some kind of life. A lot of times some sort of plant thriving on whatever it can find in those environments. And in a way, that's encouraging to us because we can see very clearly in the scriptures that faith is the same way. When it finds good soil, no matter where it is, it can flourish in the most challenging of environments. And so, of course, we expect faith to flourish in the type of environment that God tried to create for his people in Israel, where there were godly families and godly education and a nation ruled by his rules. But we also see that in examples such as Joseph and Daniel, that people could also choose to be faithful to God, even in places where they were in an unholy land, surrounded by people who did not follow God's laws, who did not set out to seek God in their lives. And so we see those examples. Those are encouraging for us today, because I believe we could all agree there are some things about Daniel that we can relate to. Daniel was, of course, forcibly hauled away to some foreign place. But we have a kind of a weird difference in that the difference for us is often that we're staying put, but it's as if the ground is shifting under our feet. The country in which we live is changing. So we aren't going to some faraway place, most of us, but even right where we are, maybe if you've been here all along, you see that all around you, the nation itself is becoming more and more unholy. It's not that the United States was ever God's people and God's nation, and the world as a whole has always been under the power of the evil one. But I think we can all see very clearly that for a long time, our values, the morals that held the fabric of our society together were rooted in Christian values. And so even if you might disagree on some doctrinal issues with people, pretty much everybody agreed on what was right and wrong on the whole, but that's changing pretty quickly. And I won't belabor that point because it's something we all are aware of. But we see things that used to be strange and things that used to be far away and things that used to be universally frowned upon are now close to home and are now celebrated and are now held up as the norm. I know a guy in Fayetteville who works on the Arsenal, and he was telling me not long ago that there's a man in his group of people he works with who's decided and declared that he's now a woman. And so they are going through some training in the process of figuring out restrooms and how to deal with all of those. That's here and now. It's not like in some faraway place. In my Cub Scout den, when we first moved to Fayetteville, my oldest was in second grade. And so when I started as his leader, there was a core group of about 12 guys, and they stayed with me all the way through till they crossed over to be Boy Scouts. And one of those young men who went on to become an Eagle Scout, who's now a senior in high school with my son, has announced to the world that he is homosexual. And so, in Little Fayetteville, Tennessee, in high schools, and it's everywhere that the world is changing. And now not only is the things that used to be strange, we're being told this is normal and good, but actually we're finding that if you stand on God's word, you are the one who is becoming strange. If you say, I believe that the world was created by God, you're becoming strange. If you say, I believe that these things are wrong and this is what's right, you are the one who is the odd man out. You are the one who's being tried to be labeled as hateful and those kinds of things. So we are, without being dragged away to some place thousands of miles away, we are finding ourselves as being called upon, as Daniel was, to be holy in the midst of an unholy land. And so I think this example of Daniel in his book is one that's very encouraging and relevant to our times. And so in our lesson tonight, of course, there's lots to say about Daniel. We're going to look at two examples. The very first one we find when he was confronted right away with a conflict between his culture and his conscience in what he was going to eat. That's the first lesson we'll look at and think about as he's a young man. Then we'll fast forward into his later years as he's an older man in the incident with what we usually call Daniel in the lion's den. And so it's interesting that we have these two peeks into the life of Daniel, one when he's very young and one closer to the end of his life. And they both give us lessons that we can learn and take away from and apply to our lives as we are also, whatever our age, trying to be holy in an unholy land. So to think about this first example, and that is a conflict of Daniel's culture and his conscience, we see in this case, and this is one of the differences between the first and the last lesson. In the first case, Daniel, through wisdom and humility and God's grace, is able to resolve this conflict peacefully without it really coming to a head. And that's something I think we can learn some things from this example as well along those lines. So you'll recall, of course, that Daniel and his friends were taken captives in the first wave of captives as God was punishing his people, Judah, and he said, this is it, I'm pulling the plug, you're going to have to go away into captivity. Well, that happened in three different waves of captives. And Daniel and some friends were part of the very first ones to go. We read about that in verses 3 and 4 of Daniel chapter 1. Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance, and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace, and to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. In a very real sense, I'm trying to imagine how terrifying this must have been if you're young Daniel, who's probably of royal blood in some way, but there he is, and people come in, men, adults, army guys, they are speaking a language you can't understand. I'm almost positive Daniel would not have at first been familiar with anything they were saying. And they're going through and they're somehow finding they've been given a criteria of people to look for. And they're identifying these young men and they figure out that you're one of them. And they say words you can't understand. The next thing you know, they're taking you with them and you're being carried away and you don't even know what their plan is for you. Now, as it turns out, this is a pretty good assignment for Daniel, compared to what's coming for the people who are left behind. But he wouldn't know that at first. He wouldn't realize that the first wave has really got it the best of all of the captives. These people are hauling him off. Now, when you think about what's actually going to happen, they're looking for bright young people that they can educate. So in a sense, we could say Daniel's going off to college. I mean, isn't that basically what's happened? He's a young person, but he's being uprooted from his family. He's being taken to somewhere else. And while he's there, he's going to be taught in all of their learning. So in their understanding of science and their understanding of history and their understanding of religion, there would be classes taught by their wisest people to this class of young people from all over the kingdom. So Daniel would be arriving there with people from other parts of the empire, of the Babylonian empire, and they're all going to be educated along these ways, which would be terrifying. Again, now imagine you're Daniel's parents, but some of us are closer to that end of the spectrum where young people are going to go somewhere and they're going to be educated by other people. And can they hang on to their identity? Is Daniel going to be able, or is he just going to lose completely who he is? Or is he going to be able to thrive in this setting while maintaining his, faith in God and living according to God's laws? And of course, that is what Daniel's going to do. And that's what makes it interesting to us. They're going to be tested right away. Basically, as soon as they arrive, notice what we're told in verse 5. The king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and of the wine that he drank. They were to be educated for 3 years. At the end of that time, they were to stand before the king. It takes 4 years to get a bachelor's degree now. Babylonians were a little more efficient, apparently. But they've got Daniel and friends there. And this, the fact that they were going to be fed from the king's food is a huge honor for them. I mean, the king is basically saying, these are the best and brightest of the whole empire, and I want them to eat what I'm eating. If I'm feeling like having this today, that's what they're going to have. Whatever they prepared for the king, the young people got to eat as well. You would think, this is awesome. I mean, this is going to be wonderful experience for Daniel, but this presents a problem right away. Something about the food was objectionable to Daniel. Notice in verse 8, it says, the king, Daniel resolved or purposed in his heart, the New King James says, I'm reading from the English Standard Version, by the way, but that he resolved or purposed in his heart, he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Something about this food was objectionable. Something about it wasn't acceptable to Daniel. It isn't explained to us what it was. Probably because he goes on to say, why don't you just feed us vegetables? It had to do with the meats they were eating. Perhaps they were the wrong kinds of meats. Maybe everything was wrapped in bacon. Or perhaps it was that they weren't prepared according to the Jews had in the law of Moses quite a few instructions on how meat had to be from the way the animal was slaughtered and those kinds of things, how it had to be prepared, what we would call today kosher. And so in Daniel's case, he's sitting there and perhaps a plate comes in. Here's this meat on it that maybe on a, you don't know maybe where it was come from or how it was prepared. He feels like he would be defiled if he eats this meat. And that's the challenge that is presented to him right away. But notice that the way Daniel handles this is number one, to resolve or to make up his mind to decide he's not going to be defiled. It reminds me of what Elijah tells the people on Mount Carmel when he says to all the people, how long will you go limping between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, follow him. And the people did not answer him a word. How frustrating to be Elijah. And you see people who won't take a stand. I kind of like God and I do things, but I also sort of go along with the Baal worshipers. And now Elijah in that passage is saying, make up your mind. And they're quiet. Daniel, on the other hand, it says very clearly, resolved. It started with a decision in his mind, a commitment inside himself. I'm not going to defile myself. And that is the first step in his maintaining and retaining his identity as a child of God, even in this unholy land. So the next thing Daniel does, what's he going to do with this food, this problem that he's got to eat and that he doesn't feel in his conscience he can eat this food? How is he going to handle it? Well, notice that he asks. In verse 8, it says, therefore he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. The New King James says he requested. Things go so much better when we are humble, when we make requests. People respond better to requests than to demands. So when we are respectful and when in circumstances like this, it's going to work out better for us. And even though God is clearly on Daniel's side and is watching after Daniel, at first the eunuch isn't willing to give in. Notice what it said in verse 9. God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king, who assigned your food and your drink. For why should he see that you're in worse conditions than the youths of your own age, so you would endanger my head with the king? You understand what he's saying. The king has done a great thing by saying, these young men are going to eat my food. And now if you've got three or four of them that are saying, hey, we're not going to eat that stuff, and the eunuch goes along with them and listens to the college kid instead of to the king, how's that going to go for the eunuch? He says, you're putting my job, not my job, my life on the line by this request of yours to not do what the king has said and feed you guys what he's eating. Notice that Daniel could have said, well, how could Daniel have handled this? He could have said, you know, that's your problem. That's not my concern. Whatever you got going on between you and the king is your deal. I'm not eating it. He could have said, don't you understand us? We Jews, we don't eat this stuff. This is offensive to me. Take it away. Notice what Daniel suggests as he negotiates with this eunuch. Verse 11. Then Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had assigned over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who eat the king's food be observed by you and deal with your servants according to what you see. So notice how Daniel continues to be respectful. He acknowledges the authority of the eunuch. He's not just being rebellious and difficult in this. He isn't threatening. And notice that he requests a very simple, basic diet of vegetables and water. So he's basically asking for accommodations to accommodate his convictions. I mean, that's what he's asking for. He's saying, I can't in good conscience eat this, so I'm asking for special treatment. I mean, that's the bottom line. But in this special treatment that he's asking for the very lowest thing possible. He's saying, just give me the vegetables and water. He doesn't say, you know, you could prepare, I could give you some recipes from back home that I like, that mom used to make for me. Or, you know, I can teach you how to prepare this food the way that I like it or the way that would be acceptable He doesn't insist on everybody eating according to Jewish dietary laws. He just says, look, just give us vegetables and water for some period of time, and let's see how that goes. And of course, the eunuch listens, verse 14. He listened to him in this matter and tested him for 10 days. Of course, that took a lot of faith on Daniel's part. And he's also, wouldn't you agree, unless you're a vegetarian, which I know at least one person here is, but unless you're a vegetarian, you would think, you know, he's probably passing up some pretty good food too, because he's saying, just give me the vegetables and water and you guys eat those finer things that the king eats. He's willing to do all that because he's trying to stand by his convictions. And of course, as a result of all this, Daniel is blessed. Verse 15, at the end of 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh, and that would have been a good thing for this in this case, than all the youths who ate the king's food. So the steward took away their food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables. So things are working out. And things always work out when we put God first, we stand in our convictions, things are going to work out for us, and God continues to bless him. Verse 17 says, as for these four youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. In fact, it goes on to say they excelled above all the other young people. So they're blessed. And right off the bat, Daniel has resolved and decided, I'm going to follow God and his rules. And right off the bat, we see that God is watching over him and God is blessing him as a result of his seeking God in his life. And that's what God does. When we seek God, it works out to our advantage. Now, there's basically this lesson in two parts. Before we go on to the next lesson, let's just kind of right now go ahead and make some applications of this part, and then we will we'll move on to the later lesson from later in Daniel's life. So first of all, the very first lesson that we need to decide upon is to resolve not to be defiled. This was a decision Daniel made, and it's very clearly stated there that he determined, he made up his mind, he resolved not to defile himself. And it reminds me, although this didn't pop up in order, of what Paul says in 2 Corinthians 6, 17 through 18. Therefore, go out from their midst, be separate from them, says the Lord, and touch no unclean thing. Then I will welcome you, and I'll be a father to you, and you shall be sons and daughters to me, says the Lord Almighty. Who are you? Who am I? Am I a son of the king? Am I a son of God Almighty? Do you know that? If I know that, then I've got to resolve that I'm not going to defile myself with the things that are around me. That's the first thing that Daniel did. He made up his mind. That's in the opening verses of the chapter. Daniel resolved not to defile himself because he knew who he was and who he belonged to. And that's the challenge for you and me, to decide right up front that I'm going to make up my mind not to be defiled. Now, the next thing is, we think about, turn with me, to hold your place there. We'll come back to Daniel, but go to Matthew chapter 15. In Daniel's case, it was a question of cuisine, right? It was a question of food, meats and vegetables, those kinds of things. Because God had given them laws about this, what was clean and what was unclean. You couldn't eat things that were strangled, and there's lots of different rules about that. And so in Daniel's case, his conflict between the society and his conviction was over what was on his plate. But Jesus says very clearly in Matthew 15, in the new law, this is not the kind of conflict that we're really most concerned about. When we talk about don't defile yourselves, and when Paul says touch no unclean thing, we're not in our day and time thinking of the kind of food you get or what you get off the buffet when you go for lunch, obviously. In Matthew 15, the question has come up that Jesus' disciples have been accused of defiling themselves because they didn't wash their hands when they ate. So the Jews had this idea that you've got dirty hands, you're eating things, those things are now defiled. By eating those things, you are becoming defiled because you've touched them with unclean hands. And now, you know, by this process of you put defiled stuff in your mouth, you're defiled too. And Jesus clarifies the type of defilement that is really important for us as Christians. Verse 10 of Matthew 15. He called the people to him and said, hear and understand, it is not what goes into the mouth that defiles a person, but what comes out of the mouth, this defiles a person. Now this blew their minds. In fact, the disciples just admit later when they get inside, they say, tell us about that again. What are you talking about? What does it mean? It's not what comes into my mouth that defiles, what goes out of my mouth. How does that even make sense? You could see how all their life they were very careful about what they put in their mouth. And now Jesus is saying, it's not that, it's what comes out of your mouth. And so he has to explain what he means. Down in verse 17, he says, do you not see that whatever goes into the mouth passes into the stomach and then is expelled? But what comes out of the mouth proceeds from the heart, and this defiles a person. For out of the heart come evil thoughts, murder, adultery, sexual immorality, theft, false witness, slander. These are what defile a person. To eat with unwashed hand does not defile anyone. Jesus gives him a little anatomy lesson, is what it boils down to. He says, look, think about it. You got dirty hands, you eat something, it goes in your mouth, it just passes through your digestive tract, right? But it doesn't make its way to your heart. And here, when he says heart, he means mind, because he talks about evil thoughts. This is where they reside. So, the Bible speaks of your heart, talking about your mind. And so Jesus is saying, look, think about it. What you eat doesn't go into your mind. It doesn't go into your thinking. It goes into your belly, and then it's expelled, and that's the end of it. So that's not what defiles you. Where sin doesn't originate in the guts. Sin originates in the mind. Sin originates in the thought. Sin is in the lustful thought, the hateful thought, the greedy thought. When that greed turns into theft, when the lust turns into sexual immorality, when those thoughts are allowed to persist and turn into lusting after someone or hating someone, that's where the sin resides in the mind, and that's not going to be affected by eating with dirty hands. That's not going to make me lust after someone. That's not going to make me hate someone or those kinds of things. So Jesus is distinguishing here between food type cleanliness and the more important moral things of the heart. So now when we think about that and we think about Daniel's example, how does that apply to us? Well, if the mouth isn't connected to the brain in the sense of what goes into it, what does feed right into the brain? Well, we can think our eyes do, right? And our ears do. How we take information, where does that go? When I look at something, where is it going? It's not going to my stomach. It's going right into my mind. When I listen to things, where is it going? It's going straight into my mind. The things I dwell on, the things I think on, the things I watch. Now, are there a lot of defiled things around that I could be feeding my mind and defiling myself with? There's tons of stuff like that. Living as holy in an unholy land, we're surrounded by a smorgasbord of unclean, defiled foods for the brain. And we need to be very careful that we guard our hearts with all diligence. Because this is where the things of life come from. This is where our thoughts, the things we meditate on, come from what we feed into our minds. And so what is it going to take for someone to be holy in an unholy land? Maybe we have to live on a diet of vegetables when it comes to entertainment, when it comes to, the things we read and think about and dwell on. There's a lot of stuff out there that's defiled. We need to be very careful about the diet that we feed our brains, because that is our mind, where lustful thoughts, depending on the things we look at on the internet, things we subscribe to on our, Instagram feed or whatever, the things that and if that's a constant feed of things that cause us to have lustful thoughts or things that cause us to have greedy thoughts, jealousy, anger, those kinds of things, that is the type of defilement that Christians are to be concerned about. So let's make up our minds, just as Daniel did, not to be defiled. And then I think the next point about this that's very interesting from a practical point of view is, in school, in work, there'll be times in our lives when we find ourselves like Daniel in a conflict where we're being handed something or asked to do something or participate that violates our conscience. And how are we going to handle those? Daniel gives us some interesting insight here by his very respectful, practical, humble, common sense kind of appeal to his superior. Say, hey, could I please have this? And he's not really asking for anything fancy. He just says, let me have the basic things. And he's very respectful. He's very polite. And because he handled it that way, the whole conflict was able to be resolved. And I think that's very true in many cases, whether it's you've been assigned to read a book that you find is objectionable. Probably that teacher has other books that you could read if you ask in a respectful way. Or you've been assigned to work and that conflicts with, you want to be at Bible study on Wednesday night, let's say, or on Sunday. And the part-time job guy puts you down for that night, and you'd like, probably there's a way to say, hey, I will work the night where nobody else wants to work. Let me have Friday night that everybody else wants to be off, and sign me up for, and let me have off on this night. or if someone's asking you to work on some project and you feel like in good conscience, this thing isn't upright and true and good. Very often, if we follow Daniel's lead here of being respectful and making requests, people will make accommodations just as the eunuch made accommodations for him, so that we can continue to stand on our convictions while operating in the midst of an unholy culture. But not always. And that brings us to our next section, because sometimes we can't resolve that conflict. Sometimes it's not going to go away. Sometimes it's a test. And sometimes we have to stand and pay whatever the price is for saying, I'm not going to do that because this is my conviction. So we go to Daniel chapter 6. This comes from the latter end of Daniel's life. That's not always necessarily clear. But in this case, you know, I don't know how you picture Daniel in the lion's den. He's an older man. The full 70 years of captivity are nearing an end when we come to Daniel in Daniel chapter 6. And so he was carried away as a young man at the beginning of that time. Tack on 70 years, he's probably in his 80s now, as this next test comes. So we're now at the other end of his life when this happens. Several kings have come and gone since Nebuchadnezzar. Now the guy on the phone is Darius. And so this is the Medes and the Persians have begun. The rule of Babylon is over. Now, what's happened in the meantime? Interestingly, Daniel has thrived. He's been very successful. Look at chapter 6, verses 1 and 2. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps to be throughout the whole kingdom. Over them, three high officials, of whom Daniel was one, to whom these satraps should give account so that the king might not suffer loss. Isn't it fascinating that a devout Jew could move up the ranks of a place, an empire run by Babylonians, Medes, Persians, completely foreign to God's ways, and yet they've got Daniel here and they have promoted him all the way up to, if you look at the structure of the organization of the empire, you've got all the people all over their empire, 120 people over them, over those 123 people, and Daniel's one of those three. And, you know, it's in some ways it's not a surprise, because very often God-fearing people are successful. And, you know, I know many God-fearing people who are successful in the room here are successful people, because if we really put into practice God's rules for how to work, if we're honest and hardworking, we do our best no matter who's watching, and we're, you know, that kind of person, in an ideal setting, that's the kind of person people are looking for as an employee. Somebody that is trustworthy. Somebody who's going to be doing the right thing that you don't have to worry about that they're, you know, as soon as you turn away, they're going to be goofing off or whatever. So if you work by those Christian principles, it isn't surprising that somebody says, hey, here's a young man, here's a young lady that is doing a good job. And we want to reward that person. But anyway, so Daniel has grown up through the ranks here. And in fact, verse 3, he continues to be promoted. It said, this Daniel became distinguished above all the other officials and satraps because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. It's fascinating to think about the times in the Bible where there was a God-fearing person at number 2 position in the kingdom. Can you think of some? Joseph. Number 2, over all the Egyptian kingdom. Esther ends up being queen over the kingdom of Persia. Here's Daniel, number 2, in command over the kingdom of the Medes and Persians. That's amazing to think about how far up the ladder he had risen here. But of course, with this success, creates enemies. And with his promotions, there's jealousy. And there's other people who are against him, who don't want him to be placed over them. So watch what happens next. In verse 4, then the high officials and the satraps sought to find ground for complaint against Daniel with regard to the kingdom. But they could find no ground for complaint or any fault because he was faithful, and no error or fault was found in him. We need to be ready for this. And that is, if we set ourselves apart by saying, I'm going to do the right thing, and I'm going to stand on convictions, and I've got principles, and I'm going to live by these things, people are going to start watching. And especially if you're given any kind of success, there's people who will be jealous, and there's people who will keep an eye on you. And what they're looking for is this person real or not? Are there chinks in the armor? Are they just pretending? Are they a hypocrite? They're going to watch to see if I practice what I preach. If I've said, I'm not going to do that, that's wrong, but then they see me over here doing other things that are wrong, they're going to see right through that. And that's what they think of a lot of religious people, that they're not for real. And so in today's world, more than anything else, authenticity is what people are looking for, what they respect. So they're going to look and see, are you real? And they're trying here with a critical eye to find some flaw in Daniel. And that reminds me of what Paul said to Titus in Titus 2:7-8, where he said, show yourself in all respects to be a model of good works. In your teaching, show integrity, dignity, and sound speech that cannot be condemned, so that an opponent may be put to shame, having nothing evil to say about us. Paul says to young Titus, you preach the word, but you live it, so that when opponents are looking at you and they're trying to find something that they can pick at, they're not going to be able to find anything. That's a high standard, isn't it? And yet that's exactly what Daniel's doing here, because these guys can't stand him and they are looking for something and they can't find anything. So they think the only way we're going to be able to bring him down is if we find a way to use his religion against him. And of course, that's what they do. In verse 5, it said, these men said, we will not find any ground for complaint unless we find it in connection with the law of his God. Of course, you know what happens next. They go to the king. They appeal that he pass a law for some goofy reason. We know why they're behind it. I don't know why he went along with it. But the law is nobody can pray to anybody but you for 30 days. We have to see this as a fall of pride on the part of the king that he even went along with such a kind of crazy rule to say nobody can pray to anybody but me for 30 days. But that's the rule, and that's the law that's passed. And as soon as that's passed, how is Daniel going to respond? Notice in verse 10, when Daniel knew that the document had been signed, he went to his house where he had windows in his upper chamber open toward Jerusalem. He got down on his knees 3 times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he had done previously. Interesting thing about this, when the temple was being dedicated, Solomon said a prayer. You remember they set up a platform and he got up and he prayed and he dedicated the temple. In his prayer of dedication, he talked about the fact that one day God's people might be hauled off to some faraway land. And this is what he said. If they sin against you, some point in the future, this is Solomon speaking, for there's no one who does not sin. If you're angry with them and give them to an enemy, so they're carried away captive to a land far or near. That's what's happened. And if they repent with their mind and with their heart, in the land of their captivity, which they are carried captive, and pray toward their land, which you gave to their fathers, the city that you've chosen, the house that I built for your name, then hear from heaven your dwelling place, their prayer and their pleas, maintain their cause, and forgive your people who have sinned against you. So Solomon had said way back here, he's praying to God, sometime in the future, God, if you get angry with your people and you haul them away, and if they turn and they pray to Jerusalem, hear their prayer. And God answers this, if you keep reading, says, I will do that. If they do that, I will listen to prayer. So here's Daniel, long ways from home, 3 times a day, turning his face toward Jerusalem, just as Solomon had said, and praying that way. Now, he's not making a show of his faith. He's not making a show of his prayers. In fact, he went to his own home, and he went in an upper room and opened his windows. And it reminds me of what Jesus said, when you pray, don't be like the hypocrites who stand on the corner trying to get attention. But go into your room, go into your closet, go into some private place to pray. It doesn't mean you can't pray in public. We do that. We have examples of Jesus praying in public. But what Jesus is saying is don't use your prayers as a way to try to show off how good you are, to use your religion as a way to make others think that you're somehow this wonderful, holy person. And that's not what Daniel's doing, because he's at home, he's in his upper room, and he's looking out his window. In fact, I would say to you, there's no way these 3 men could have seen him praying unless they were there spying on him. Because he wasn't doing this as a show of his religion. Verse 11 says that these men came by agreement and found Daniel making petition and plea before his God. Of course, they run, tell the king, and he's forced to keep his own law, which means casting Daniel in the lion's den. He's sick about it. We're told he spent the whole rest of the day trying to find a way out of it. There's no way out of it. And so, verse 16, the king commanded, Daniel was brought and cast into the den of lions. And the king declared to Daniel, may your God, whom you serve continually, deliver you. And a stone was brought and laid on the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet and the signet of his lords that it might not be changed concerning Daniel. Then the king went to his palace and spent the night fasting, fled from him. The king's up all night worried about Daniel. Daniel's somewhere nearby in a den full of lions. Of course, what's going to happen? Then at daybreak, verse 19, the king arose and went in haste to the den of the lions. And he came to near to the den where Daniel was, and he cried out in a tone of anguish. Of course, he thinks there's a good chance Daniel has not lived through the night. The king declared to Daniel, "O Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions?" And Daniel said to the king, "O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me, because I was found blameless before him, and also before you, O king. I have done no harm." You know, the king had been up all night. It doesn't tell us whether Daniel was up all night or not. He might have slept pretty good once he saw how this was going to go. But you remember what happens next. The king gets those wicked men. They are fed to the lions. Instead, Daniel is released. And look how God is glorified in chapter 6, verse 25, beginning. "The king Darius wrote to all the peoples, nations, and languages that dwell on all the earth, 'Peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in all my royal dominion, people are to tremble and fear before the God of Daniel, for he is the living God, enduring forever. His kingdom shall never be destroyed. His dominion shall be to the end. He delivers and rescues. He works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. He who has saved Daniel from the power of the lions." So now God has been glorified and honored throughout the entire kingdom. Why? Because Daniel chose to put his faith in God and to stand on his convictions and not to give in and to keep doing what he thought was right and pay whatever price came with that. And that's what happens when we stand up for God. No matter the outcome, God is going to be glorified. The point I would like to make in general is that we can't always avoid a conflict between culture and conscience. So living as trying to be holy in the midst of an unholy people is going to mean that we're going to be confronted with things that violate our conscience. We have to make a choice about it. Very often, like Daniel, if we use humility and respect and we're polite, we can find solutions to that where we don't have to violate our conscience and we're still able to be successful in our job or, you know, pass the course or whatever that thing may be. But it may be that the time comes when it's a test, when somebody has it out for us, when they're not about to make an exception for you, when they're not about to let you off to do this thing or let you out of this assignment or whatever, because they don't like the fact that you're standing up for your convictions and there are those people out there. And when that time comes, we have to be like Daniel and be willing to pay the price. Whether that price means getting fired from my job, whether that price means being failed out of a class, whether that price means being thrown in jail, if that price means losing your life. Have people been willing to pay that price throughout history to stand up for the Lord? Absolutely they have. Is anything less required of us today? No. So we have to be willing, like Daniel, to say, "I'm going to stand by the Lord. I'm going to do what's right." If we do that, and if we die, still a happy ending, isn't it? And guess who's glorified in the end? God is glorified. No matter what, when we stand up for God, when we stand up for our convictions, when we say, "I'm not backing down," God is going to be glorified. Whether we're delivered from that trial or not, God is going to be glorified. Because in the end, there is a lion who is out there seeking to destroy us. But who's more powerful than him? The God we serve. The lion won't destroy us. If we put our faith in God and we decide, "I'm going to stand with him and I'm going to do what's right, no matter what the cost," then we can be like Daniel and God will be glorified through us. And our story is going to have a happy ending because God's people are going to be victorious in the end. Perhaps there's someone here this evening who has not yet named the name of Christ, who has not said, I want to be a Christian. I want to serve this God who is awesome and who is over all the universe, who is going to win in the end, and I want to be on his side, and I want to be forgiven, and I want to be a Christian. If you haven't yet made that decision, and perhaps that's something that's been weighing on your mind, maybe you'd like to learn more about it. I know there's many people here who would love to study that with you and share with you more about the gospel of Christ. Or maybe you know exactly what you need to do, but for some kind of reason you put it off and waited. Wouldn't it be awesome here this evening to wrap things up by deciding to give your life to Christ? If there's someone here tonight who's never done that, the instructions we find as Jesus sent his disciples out to go make more disciples are very simple. Go tell them the good news. And those who believe that good news, who are willing to repent, become disciples, which means to follow him and have their sins washed away in baptism, teach them to preserve all that I've commanded you. It's really, the beginning part of it is very simple. And if we can help anyone do that now, we would love to if you let us know while we stand and sing. shine.